Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Advocates of ending solitary confinement in New York's prison ended the 2019 legislative session disappointed that changes made to the practice did not go further. They say they'll be back again to fight for more progress next year. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt with more.
Victor Pate spent 90 days in solitary confinement when he was serving a prison term for robbery. That was 23 years ago, but Pate says he still feels like a trauma survivor.
I oftentimes still feel the effects of being in solitary confinement, and it doesn't take but a moment for me to be transformed back to that moment, either in the yard or either being in that solitary confinement. So because I never, ever got treatment for the trauma that I suffered while I was in solitary confinement.
Pate is now part of the advocacy group Halt Solitary Confinement. He and others spent several days outside the Senate and Assembly chambers in the closing days of the session. Some even camped out outside Governor Andrew Cuomo's offices one night, and others went on a hunger strike. Halt Scott Peltrowitz says the practice of confining inmates to small cells for 23 hours a day with 1 hour for exercise is cruel and inhumane. He says the United Nations agrees, and in 2015 its General Assembly, with the approval of the United States, passed what's known as the Mandela Rules, named after former South African President Nelson Mandela. He endured decades in prison under the country's former apartheid government. The UN found that more than 15 days in a row in solitary confinement is equivalent to torture.
But in New York, people regularly spend months and years and even decades in solitary. People have spent 30 years in solitary confinement in New York. It's torture. It's barbaric. It has to stop.
Pate and Paltrowitz hope that the all-Democratic state legislature would act on a bill to limit solitary confinement to a maximum of 15 days in a row and no more than 20 days in a 60-day period. Under the bill, solitary confinement would be used as a punishment for committing a violent act, possessing a dangerous weapon, or trying to escape. The prisons would also have to provide therapeutic rehabilitation for prisoners afterward. Prison guard unions, including the New York City-based Correction Officers Benevolent Association, oppose the bill, saying further limiting solitary confinement would lead to more assaults on guards. The New York State Correctional Officers and Police Benevolent Association say the bill is anti-union and puts the lives of its members in danger, as well as compromising the safety of other inmates. In the final hours of the session, Cuomo and the legislature agreed to a more limited measure. It would restrict solitary confinement to 30 days and prohibit minors, pregnant women, and disabled inmates from the punishment. Corrections officers will undergo training and set up rehabilitation services for those released from solitary confinement. And prisons will also no longer be able to limit an inmate's diet as a form of punishment while in solitary. Cuomo also raised objections about what he said would be $1 billion in potential costs to dismantling the solitary confinement cells. He spoke on Albany Public Radio Station, WAMC.
And frankly, I don't want to build $1 billion worth of new jails. I'm proud that we've closed more jails. I'm looking for alternatives to incarceration.
The New York State Association of Counties agreed, saying while the bill is noble in its intent, the changes represent an enormous unfunded mandate that would be financed by taxpayers. Paltrowitz, with Halt, says the claim of hundreds of millions of dollars in additional costs is a red herring. And Pate says if solitary confinement is limited to 15 days, there'd be fewer people in the units.
That's not accurate, because there are actually units right now that can actually be converted for the use of residential rehabilitation, which doesn't require a cost itself.
The advocates say they'll return when the legislative session resumes in a few months. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, this week, you spoke with Governor Cuomo again. You've been having a continuing conversation about the definition of what it means to be a progressive.
He said, I mean, more money for poor schools. I mean, I'm going to stand up for minorities and the disenfranchised. I'm going to stand up and fight for the people who are in Rikers Island. I'm going to stand up for the tenants in NYCHA and public housing all across the state. You've been having this ongoing conversation with him about the definition of progressive, which, as you pointed out, mirrors what's happening on the national stage with the Squad, Nancy Pelosi, Trump, and the send her back chants.
That's a very good point you're making, David. Look, this guy, who is already being mentioned in case the Democrats lose as a 2024 presidential candidate, he'll certainly be young enough, has to preserve himself on both sides. Look, most of the Democratic Party in America is moderate. Those are the people who got elected in the blue wave and took over the House of Representatives. He started as a moderate, we know that, but he has evolved, as the old saying goes, and he's moved further left, and he has identified himself that way. And he does have a rather long list of accomplishments that he and the legislature together achieved. So he is entitled to call himself anything he wants. Look, in this age of Trump, and we do know that politicians who are able to identify themselves and to go to their core constituencies are successful. And that is something that we have to say about this governor. Electorally, he has been successful. Our friend Jesse McKinley has written a very interesting article in the New York Times, I think people should read it, about this whole question as to whether he deserves the credit or not. But he certainly has identified himself as being a progressive, and I suspect we're going to hear a lot more of that, because in an era where we have AOC and some of her people being extraordinarily prescient about the future of the Democratic Party and about progressivism, and on the other hand, he has, as I said before, the bulk of the Democratic Party, which in the middle states and everybody else have been fairly consistent in their moderation. So he's got to watch out for both sides.
And on the national scene, we saw that Thomas Fried column and the idea that in order to elect a Democrat, you can't go too far to the left. You have to be, let's say, electable progressive.
This is, David, why they talk about circular firing squads with the Democrats. The Republicans speak with pretty much one voice, whereas the Democrats, you see the AOC victory. She's very popular in her district and some of her colleagues. And yet there are consistent warnings that if the Democratic Party goes too far left, they're going to lose the election. And you have no bigger supporter of that theory than Donald Trump, who is identifying them as the face of the Democratic Party, these progressives. So that's what he wants. Let's see whether his guess is right.
If you look at what we see in the headlines, the base is fired up. Two Louisiana police officers now fired over Facebook posts suggesting AOC should be shot. They are riling up the base.
Yeah, look, this is disgusting. When things get to that point where people who have political rhetoric that disturbs others are threatened with their lives, firing them is one thing, but I think it's far worse when a police department, any police department, where the people that they recruit start to get political. I do think it's a time for some serious FBI and other intervention. Unfortunately, we have an FBI right now, which has got the wraps on, obviously, because of Trump. But it is very important that the officials who guarantee our civil liberties watch the police.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Congressional representatives from New York are back after visiting facilities on the U.S. southern border to see firsthand the conditions for processing and holding undocumented immigrants. Democratic Congressman Antonio Delgado joined a delegation to Texas and says the problem is complex. More from the Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn.
The 19th District Democrat traveled with members of the House Homeland Security Committee to McAllen, Texas, July 19th. The bipartisan delegation visited a Border Patrol station, processing center, holding facility, and Hidalgo Port of Entry. Congressman Delgado says they also visited the New Hope Children's Center.
The biggest takeaway was, aside obviously from the conditions which are unconscionable and need to be addressed immediately, but also just the complexity of this issue. There's no doubt a surge. The numbers speak for themselves in terms of families coming from Central America. And the president's policies, I think, have exacerbated the situation. So we have facilities that are not designed to detain families or even adults for extended periods of time being asked do so. And because of that, they're not equipped, which leads to some of the inhumane conditions that we've had to witness.
He says there is a clear uptick in Central Americans seeking relief from extreme poverty and violence and those seeking asylum.
And so that is something that, you know, you can't pinpoint to any one administration. It dates back to a long history of, you know, I would argue policy decisions in part made by different administrations that have impacted that region in a negative fashion. All the more reason why some of the discussion now has to be with leaders of that region, along with our allies, to figure out exactly what we can do to offer humanitarian aid and relief in that region.
Also on July 19th, U.S. Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer and other Senate Democrats, including Connecticut's Richard Blumenthal, traveled to McAllen, Texas with the same purpose. They visited the largest migrant intake facility on the southern border, the Ursula RGV Centralized Processing Center. Schumer said the conditions for migrants at facilities on the southern border are unbearable, inhumane, and heartbreaking. In response, President Trump says he will meet with Schumer and tweeted July 21st, quote, "Senator Chuck Schumer has finally gone to the southern border with some Democrat senators. This is a great thing." Nearby, he missed a large group of illegal immigrants trying to enter the USA illegally. They wildly rushed Border Patrol. Some agents were badly injured. Trump also tweeted, "Based on the comments made by Senator Schumer, he must have seen how dangerous and bad for our country the border is. It is not a manufactured crisis as the fake news media and their Democrat partners tried to portray. He said he wants to meet. I will set up a meeting ASAP." Monday in Albany, Schumer said there was, in his words, one good facility run by Catholic Charities.
Whatever people's positions are on immigration, to treat these people, you know, mothers and fathers and children, little children, so inhumanely is awful. The good news is we found an alternative down there run by Catholic Charities, Sister Norma Pimentel, and we could treat people much better and still keep rule of law by using methods like her. And I'm going to be urging the president to switch the model they use. No cages, no hundreds of people sleeping on cold floors. Use Sister Norma's model, which is right down there.
Earlier in the week, Chairwoman Nita Lowey joined her colleagues on the House Appropriations Committee in Homestead, Florida, to conduct an oversight visit of the Homestead Influx Facility for Unaccompanied Children.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo this week signed the Farm Workers Bill, which establishes worker rights and labor protections. While the governor calls it a great achievement, farm advocates say it threatens family farm operations and won't necessarily help workers. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley explains.
The new law establishes the Farm Laborers Fair Labor Practices Act, which mandates overtime pay, a day of rest each week, disability and paid family leave coverage, unemployment benefits, and other labor protections. As he signed the bill Wednesday, Governor Cuomo, a Democrat, said injustices toward farm workers will be a thing of the past.
100,000 farm workers will have better lives. The families will have better lives.
But some worry whether small farms can afford to operate under the auspices of the bill. Grow New York Farms spokesman Paul Larrabee says the bill's outcome may not be the panacea supporters expect.
In some ways, the legislation that ultimately was passed is hurting the very people it was intended to help. In fact, some of the workers are going to lose hours as a result of a requirement to pay overtime. The workers on the farms who are here for a short duration of time, and they want to work as many hours as possible. That puts the farmer in a very difficult position because he is unable to sustain an overtime wage that is excessive. It may result in some workers either not getting the hours they need, the farmers being uncompetitive, or losing workers to another state because opportunity is greater.
Grow New York Farms worked with the New York Farm Bureau and legislators to make revisions in the bill. But the version signed by the governor, according to Farm Bureau spokesman Steve Ammerman, has some major problems that will make it very difficult on the farm community and economy.
We've had some farmers tell us, I probably will not survive this. I can't absorb these costs. I know my employees are going to be wanting more hours than I will be able to provide them because of the new overtime requirements. I'm afraid I'm going to lose my employees and it'll be harder to attract new ones. There's really a lot of worry in the farm community right now and real concerns of how this is going to impact the overall rural economy. Our farms value their employees. They want to provide them good opportunities and good benefits and make sure that they remain valuable team members on their farm. But it comes down to the economics, and for some farms, they say they will not be able to survive this.
Tony LaPierre owns a dairy farm in Chazy, north of Plattsburgh. He says they have some employees originally from Latin America who work for a few months and put in 60 hours or more a week.
The gentlemen that work for us at the moment, we have three. They work 60-plus hours a week on purpose. Their sole purpose is to make money for their family back home and for when they get back.
LaPierre believes the new law will lead to reduced hours for his current employees, lower overall wages, and result in higher costs for the farm.
We're asked to manage it with hiring on more people. That's an increased cost. More people means more costs as far as workman's comp, insurances, so on and so forth.
The bill takes effect January 1st, 2020.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Well, from the farm workers bill to the number of female farmers, which is on the rise across New York. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
A Center for Economic Growth analysis of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's newly released 2017 Census of Agriculture finds a 24% increase in women farmers in the Capital Region between 2012 and 2017. Marge Randalls runs a cheese manufacturing operation in Glens Falls and a dairy farm in Argyle. She's noticed more women farmers and points out some facts that she feels are influencing the perception of women in agriculture.
The number of dairy farms has decreased significantly in New York State because of the economic. And I think there's less dairy farmers, mostly of them are male, but there's less of those, so the percentage of women increases because there's less of the dairy farmers. Small farms have been bought out by large farms. Henceforth, there might be one farm, but he might own what was four different farms. I presume you consider me a woman in agriculture. In reality, I'm a cheesemaker and own a cheese and yogurt processing business, my husband. And legally, according to IRS, we are not a farm. We're a manufacturing plant. So sometimes those lines of what's a woman in agriculture sort of seem a little fuzzy to me.
According to CEG, as of 2017, the 8-county region had 3,405 farms, and women farmers worked at 2,225, or 65% of them. Region-wide, there were 2,433 women farmers, or 40% of the 6,055 total farmers. Only the Hudson Valley had a higher concentration at 42%. At 678, Washington County was number 4 of the state's 62 counties. Eliza Pickering, originally from Vermont, now calls the Pitney Meadows Community Farms in Saratoga Springs, where she is the vegetable manager, home.
I had a lot of women farmer role models growing up, and there's a really strong network of farms in Vermont doing really neat things. I guess I've never seen it quite just as a man's role.
Pickering loves the long days and the many facets of farm work.
I like to get to the farm before everybody else and kind of get organized before they trickle in. And right now it's harvesting a lot of lettuce in the morning before 9:30. You've got to have those greens harvested, and then it's washing lettuce, getting it out to the restaurants, and then shifting gears and getting into the field and getting a lot of field maintenance done out there. You know, the crew usually leaves around 4 or 5, and I like to stay after and finish some things that didn't get done, and then I head home.
Diane Allen co-owns Lavender Farm, growing lavender in Whitehall near Lake George. Allen urges any girl or woman thinking of adapting a farm lifestyle.
If it's your passion, then go for it. It is a lot of hard work. You know, it's one of those, as with any small business, the first 24 hours of the day go to the business, and any time after that is all yours. It's a lot of hard work, but when you see how happy people are, it really makes it worthwhile.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
The governor has signed New York's climate bill into law. He calls it one of the most comprehensive climate change laws in the nation. We've been speaking with Paula DiPerna,
a special advisor to CBP, formerly known as the Carbon Disclosure Project. Ms. DiPerna formerly served as president of CCX International, Chicago Climate Exchange, a private company that pioneered climate change emissions trading worldwide with special responsibilities for China and Asia. She's testified before the Committee on Natural Resources in the United States Congress about the impacts and need to act on climate change, and she's had an audience with the Pope, who invited her to attend a major environmental conference on climate change at the Vatican.
In part three of my interview with Paula, I ask her about climate change and the creation of new climate jobs, and why the Republican Party, who often sees a choice between either jobs or the environment, hasn't capitalized on that idea.
Well, be careful what you wish for, because they may start grabbing it. But I think, you know, I interviewed a very interesting gentleman the other day named Dr. Warren Washington, who was critical to the development of climate models. He's been honored worldwide, including he was part of the IPCC that got the Nobel Prize when Al Gore got it, and President Obama also gave him the Medal of Science. He's a leading African-American scientist and, as I said, a pioneer in climate modeling. And he was an advisor to six presidents. And what he told me was that President Bush won, and I know this myself from personal experience, having met with President Bush one twice, that at that time the Republican Party really did get it. I mean, according to Dr. Washington, even John Sununu at the time, who was an extremely, polemic figure, I didn't know this, but he was a mechanical engineer. And he actually asked Dr. Washington, can you put a climate model in the White House? Literally, a moving, you know, a model that would visualize what's going on in the atmosphere. And they did that. So what has happened to the Republican Party since then is kind of a statement of deterioration, intellectual and otherwise, moral perhaps most. So, you know, why they haven't put the jobs and the climate change hasn't been put together by the Republicans, I think, has more to do with the way their party has been evolving than not understanding the case. But you could also ask the same question of the Democrats. And this false division between labor and unions, environmentalism, the environmental movement has been traditionally a kind of metaphysical thing. It seemed detached from practical operations. Long ago, 20 years ago, probably would have been the ideal time for unions to hold hands with the environmental movement and vice versa. And frankly, at one point, I think his name is Mr. Trumka from the AFL-CIO. He made a statement at the UN at an event that there was no reason for this polemic between labor and the environmental movement to exist, and that he would get on board with any program to address climate change if the environmental movement recognized that the Keystone Pipeline did represent jobs for his members, and that somehow around the issue of the Keystone Pipeline, if they could kind of, quote, compromise in the shorter run, then the longer run, the labor union would come along. Now, that may have been a devil's bargain, but in the end, you know, the fact that now the public is skeptical, they want climate change to be addressed, but nobody's giving them a recipe that they can believe in. And, you know, it's essentially a national carbon diet that we have to go on. And as far as we all know, there's about 1 million diets in the world if you want to lose weight. But when you get on that scale, you either did or didn't lose the weight. The scale doesn't care how you lost the weight or even why. And the atmosphere is the same. The atmosphere has no interest in why or how we reduce emissions, but the atmosphere has no interest whatsoever in why or how we reduce emissions. You know, but the fact is we have to reduce emissions. And it might be interesting to talk about what is the atmosphere when you think about it. You know, the public doesn't understand. If you think about it as real estate, you know, it's a space. How big is it? Well, the astronauts have told us that the relationship of the atmosphere to the Earth seen from space, one of the astronauts, I think he was on the third shuttle mission, said, you know, you look back and that atmosphere looks in the same relationship to the Earth as peach fuzz to the peach. There is nothing up there. It is absolutely the essential wafer. Think of it as a wafer that protects us from the solar radiation. And it is crowded now with greenhouse gases. And the weather, you know, we wonder, why is there unpredictable weather? Why are there these big tempests and winds and things you never see, extremes? Why? Because there's no room for that weather to move around. It's packed up there in this tight space, getting tighter every day because of this exponential growth in greenhouse gas emissions. So we just have to get rid of those atmospheric emissions. And another thing I've been writing about, it came to me one night. I thought, you know, the whole history of industrialization has been fueled literally and depended upon taking out of the earth material, organic material, that has been underground for millions of years, decaying organic matter that became oil. And our whole history of development depended on taking that out of the ground and putting it up in the atmosphere. And now our future depends on the reverse.
That's Paula DiPerna, special advisor to CDP and a global climate expert who's testified before Congress and in an audience with the Pope on the issue of climate change. And that about does it for this week's show. Get help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1930. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.